Hi, Con.
Hello, Annie.
How are you doing?
I'm doing well on this Friday afternoon.
Yeah, I'm doing well too. It's beautiful out. I'm here in my study, and you're at Heritage, right?
I am at Heritage. We're here doing filling in for, I guess, Bill and Matt today for This Week in Blog.
Yeah, we are.
And of course, I used to do This Week in Blog, so the Blogging Hens audience, the regulars, already knows me. But I've seen you on once. And I wanted to do just kind of off the top before we get into the rest of Blogging Heads. I think it's still within the realm to talk about bloggers and how they get to where they are. So I first saw your byline on a foreign policy piece about Europe's lost generation.
That was last summer and still holds true the same. But so I recently, about 3 weeks ago, I switched jobs. So I had been editing at Foreign Policy for about a year. And now I'm the economy reporter at the Washington Independent, which is an all-blog publication, basically, plus stories as well. So, I'd been covering kind of economy-type stuff at Foreign Policy while I was there, and now it's all reporting all the time.
Yeah, and you seem to be, I was checking out your work at the Independent, and you keep up a pretty good workload there.
Yeah, it's been very, very labor intensive. It's been a lot of fun since financial regulatory reform has been going on, but it's sort of been jumping into the deep end. And so, thankfully, I think that's going to take a while to pass, and it's been fun getting into the policy nitty gritty of it. And the story that you mentioned, actually, it sort of holds today, too. There's this issue, the story was about how young people suffer from really, really high rates of unemployment, and they do so in Europe for a couple demographic reasons also, and they do so in the States, and they're not doing well. And the employment this morning, the employment report this morning, they show they aren't doing well here either.
No, the long-term employer definitely have been experiencing hard times.
They really have.
One more, I guess, minor newsworthy blog note, career-related, before we get on to our today's topics, is my job before I came to Heritage was with the hotline at Blogometer, and they discontinued the Blogometer this week.
I didn't know
that. They are no longer publishing it. They are going to have all the hard news that blogs do in the normal hotline.
Okay.
So it's kind of a there's also lots of cost-cutting going on at National Journal, but it's kind of showing how the TPMs of the world, the Politicos have so blurred the lines between, what is old and new journalism that Washington institutions like the hotline that have been around for decades are now just bundling them all in together and not having not showing any difference between the two news sources.
I hadn't realized that was going on, actually.
Fair enough. Well, our first topic I think we want to talk about was the elections in the United Kingdom.
So, I guess maybe we can just give a quick rundown of the news before we go into the opinion. But basically, the election happened in the UK, which is, despite my American accent, where I grew up. And it's a hung parliament. So, the Tories and Labour and Lib Dems, nobody won an outright majority of seats. So, there's no new prime minister yet. And what's even kind of a little bit worse is that Labour and Lib Dem, they kind of get along pretty well, but even combined, they don't have enough to sort of make a parliament. So it's very, very up in the air right now as to what's going to happen. Presumably, we should know that there's like not a lot of political instability there. It's more just confusion at this point.
Right, but confusion that could lead to making it harder to make difficult decisions, which the United Kingdom is going to have to do pretty quickly.
Yeah, and I think it's this funny thing where because they Paul Krugman actually made this point on his blog that essentially Labour and Gordon Brown should have run on not bringing Britain into the Euro because it would be a lot harder and this situation would be a lot more politically fraught. Were it not for the fact that, Britain is literally an island and also politically an island that is ever so slightly outside of the utter and complete chaos that's going on the continent financially.
Wait, so Krugman was saying that the Labour Party should have run on bringing the United Kingdom out of the
EU? on saying that, we made sure that Britain still has the pound and doesn't have the euro, and therefore we saved ourselves a whole lot of grief that other countries, in particular Germany, are experiencing right now. But that wasn't.
But, what, wasn't it the Tories or conservatives that were always more EU skeptic than Labour? I thought Labour was the big push to get the United Kingdom to link their economy tighter to the EU.
Yeah, they had been. So the Tories had been traditionally much more Eurosceptic. But now it's been this funny thing where I think that nobody really wants to be involved too closely in the tumult that's going on there. And so Labour, it was a Labour government that had been responsible for making sure, basically, that Britain didn't join the Euro back when, you know, the other countries were doing.
Okay, so they were the ones that were actually in power when it happened.
Yeah, exactly.
Not that it was Labour and the left in Britain that was pushing for that to happen.
Yeah, and I actually don't know politically enough about whether at some other point Labour had been pushing for Britain to join the Euro very, very strongly. But you know, that hadn't been a consideration certainly since the recession had been going on. I think that Britain was happy to have the pound. And yeah, so what do you think? What's your response to the crisis that's going on over there, and what's the best stuff that you've seen about it?
Oh well, I think the important thing to note, you know, for the subtext on the right is all about, you know, should the Republicans mirror what David Cameron and the Conservatives have done, what the Tories have done, as far as moderating their stance and generally becoming kind of more liberal. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there was definitely an ambivalence on the right about David Cameron's chances, in that, you know, it's always good when another leftist government gets voted out of office. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if David Cameron came in and really kicked butt and had a strong majority and a strong mandate, he would kind of, you know, validate the David Frums of the world arguing for the Republicans to, you know, moderate in order to try to reach the center. Mm-hmm. So you have a lot of blogging on the right about kind of undermining that, saying, you know, part of the reason why Cameron wasn't able to succeed as well as he did was because of the moderation. Mm-hmm. So Dennis Boyles over at the Corner highlights a John O'Sullivan piece from The Spectator that actually came out before the election. Mm-hmm. But basically highlighted this concern. He writes, I think the Tory leadership as a group forgot how to manage its broad church coalition. They went from realizing that the base was insufficient for victory to believing that it was an obstacle to victory. In pursuing centrist voters, they were in suicide about losing their voters to the right. Their desire to demonstrate Tory support for public services led them to embrace Labour's budgetary strategy until shortly after the Ruth fell-in. It prevented the Tories from deriving any political benefit from Labour's budgetary implosion. So basically, he's saying the Conservative Party, the Tories, gave up their brand name by embracing much of the Labour's agenda, mm-hmm. and allowed for a larger Lib Dem opening to come up. For conservative bloggers, this is a warning to the Republicans not to do the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, although, you know, I think that this argument has been made in the blogosphere also, that the parties are such terrible, terrible analogs for each other, because most, you know, Tory members of Parliament, including Cameron himself, would be basically on the, you know, pretty far to the left among liberals in the United States, and that the situation, it's hard to make that kind of cross-country analysis, because basically the social state in Britain is massive. And, you know, obviously there's like a single payer healthcare system, and there's a really strong social democrat, you know, tradition in Britain. And then kind of on top of that, there, you know, throughout the recession especially, Cameron has run, and despite the fact, so similarly to the United States, Britain is, you know, eventually going to be somewhat crushed by its changing demographics and the fact that it has a massive, massive deficit problem also. But Cameron has basically said that this is all the more reason that we need to sort of strengthen the social safety net. And, you know, he does talk about cuts here and there, and everybody is talking about cuts. But it isn't the same sort of thing where I think that the Republicans in the United States have basically said, you know, it's time for government to get a lot stronger, not for us to be, you know, expanding the size because of the recession.
Yeah, but I think when you look back at the Reagan Revolution, it was kind of, you know, presaged by, you know, Thatcher coming to power first, and there definitely was a feeling at the time that the two revolutions were linked. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, you look in the past, you have had kind of Blair and Clinton were also linked in that same way. So mm-hmm. I think there is a history of looking at political trends in both countries and saying, you know, they're kind of going the same direction. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what, you know, conservatives don't want to see this time, is they don't want to see Republicans going in the direction of that the Tory Party has chosen.
Yeah, I think that that's certainly a fair argument. But again, I guess that, like, you know, even, and do you think that there's, like, among conservatives in the United States, do you think that there is, like, a strong identification with the Tories, or do you think that there's, like, sort of criticism that, like, what they should be doing is going further to the right? That's kind of the argument that you were making.
I'm saying that there definitely is not an identification with the Tories today.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the situation, it remains fairly in flux, and it's sort of funny watching the arguments that they're making, because it is so different over there, right? And the way that they campaigned was so different. And it's funny that you actually see the conservatives starting to sort of emulate. This is a point that Alex Massey of The Spectator has made, that you really do see politicians of all political stripes over there kind of emulating the presidential style politics that you see in America. So this election has been much less about party and much more about these individuals, much more about Gordon Brown, much more about David Cameron, much more about Nick Clegg, which is something of a departure for Britain. And a way in which they're kind of like emulating the American parties.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see if that continues. I bet it will.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, I think that it's also sort of a response to technological change, and, you know, the fact that they had these sort of televised debates for the first time that were American style. It does seem that that's kind of like the direction that they're heading in.
Very true. Well, whoever ends up forming a government will have to deal with Greece.
Mm-hmm.
Which is the other kind of big story of the week.
Yeah.
What has been going on? Has the left been saying much of anything about what's going on in Greece?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been interesting to see the bloggers that have been tackling this. Obviously, the economics bloggers. So, you know, for instance, like Paul Krugman has written sort of extensively about the situation. I'll start here. I think that the markets bloggers, so people like Felix Salmon, have basically been saying that, you know, there's been a lot of sturm und drang over the U.S. stock market, especially with the kind of boomerang this week, and over the banks with the financial regulatory reform. But really what people need to be watching is these big macroeconomic trends and sovereign debt problems. And so Felix Salmon has written sort of very convincingly that the issues are not over there, and that, you know, essentially things are going to get worse before they're going to get better, because Europe has not been fast enough and has not been forceful enough in helping Greece out with this pretty, pretty terrible situation that's going to be very difficult to ameliorate. And you know, the fact that basically the situation in Greece has been bad for months now, and it's only coming to a head very slowly. It's like watching a car crash.
Been very slow. We've been seeing these headlines for, it has been months. It seems definitely weeks, definitely about, I would say, at least a month and a half.
Yeah, I mean, I think at this point it's been months. And it's certainly, you know, they've been talking, Greece has been talking about these cuts for months. There's been waves and waves of, like, slowly cutting back on government services and shutting buildings down and turning lights off and all that.
So correct if I'm wrong, though, Krugman is somewhat skeptical of the value of bailing out Greece, no?
From reading
his column today, he seems to be saying, you know, they should go ahead and they're going to eventually default anyways. Am I reading him wrong?
No, I mean, I think that you're reading him correctly. You know, I think that, yeah, it seems to me, though, that the argument on the left has been this is too little and too late, and to a certain extent that there isn't maybe much that can be done. Yeah, so I guess Krugman is saying that there isn't maybe much that can be done at this juncture, that, you know, had things been sort of prevented earlier and had the intervention been much stronger earlier, you know, because they're still negotiating over the very end of what this bailout is going to be looking like.
Yes.
At this point, they still, you know, it's still actually not made, which is...
And they've been negotiating for a long time.
Yeah, they've been negotiating for absolutely ages, yeah.
Well, I mean, on the right, what you're seeing is, you know, Jim DeMint had a guest post over at the Daily Caller the other day, and it was widely picked up by usual suspects on the right, you know, Instapundit, Michelle Malkin,
mm-hmm.
You know, pointing out that, you know, we funded the IMF by $108 billion last year. And the DeMint's point being that he had an amendment to strike that out, but that Obama specifically attached it to a defense appropriations bill, which is the classic Washington way to make the other party vote for something that they don't want to vote for, is to attach a defense spending bill.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think what you're going to see and what you're already seeing is a move by the right to tie this bailout of Greece that even the Paul Krugmans of the world say is going to be a failure, mm-hmm. to the long line of Obama bailouts of AIG, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, GM, Chrysler, all the rest of them, and now the Obama administration is now going to be bailing out Greece as well.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, do we want U.S. taxpayer dollars going for yet another bailout? That's not going to work.
Yeah. It's a good question, and you know, I think that when he was speaking earlier, Obama, about the jobs numbers, he actually addressed this and addressed it in sort of like a very, very, very careful kind of couched way, where he said that it was as if to assure the markets without actually saying anything. You know, I think he just mentioned that he was aware of the situation and had been talking to Angela Merkel. And, you know, so I think...
But he's not in the Krugman camp. He's definitely bailouts full speed ahead.
Obama is?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I think that... I guess it becomes a matter of necessity, right? You know, so they have to be weighing this risk of the risk of doing nothing. I guess that the political problem is that it's going to be sort of difficult for the White House to demonstrate the way in which the Greek default, if it happens... is going to hurt Americans. I think that case is really, really difficult to translate. Whereas I think that, you know, of course it would be easy and true for the Jim DeMints of the world and a lot of other people to say, well, this is just one in a long line of bailouts.
Yes, it is easy to say and fun too.
Yeah.
But speaking of long lines of bailouts and things to make sure they don't happen to do in the future,
mm-hmm.
you mentioned that you've been on the financial regulation beat.
Yes.
I think the Center for American Progress, their Think Progress today, is mm-hmm. pushing financial regulation across the finish line.
Mm-hmm.
You guys are almost there. What do you think about the prospects of the bill, and more importantly, you know, what do you think has been the important lefty blog message on this?
Well, so yeah, I think that financial regulatory reform will take a good long while to come to the finish line just because of the sheer number of amendments and the sort of complexity of stuff that remains going on. But, you know, to just kind of like summarize where we are right now and where the lefty blogosphere is, there were sort of two big things that happened this week. One is that Sherrod Brown and Ted Kaufman's amendment to break the banks up, which had been supported by a lot of the lefty blogosphere. Because
many on the right.
And many on the right,
as,
yeah.
As I'm
there was
sure
actually,
you know.
On both of these things, there was interesting kind of like bipartisan support from both sides on this and then on audit the Fed, which there hasn't been a vote yet. They're waiting for Bob Bennett to come back from Utah in order to vote on it. Literally held the vote up for that, which was reported by Talking Points Memo. It was Brian Beutler, who's been doing a lot of the really good spade work on the left on this bill, along with Ryan Grimm at HuffPo and some of the other bloggers there. But, yeah, so you know, the Brown and Kaufman Amendment, which had some sort of broad support, it just didn't make it across the finish line. The final vote was, I think it was voted down like 61-33. But then audit the Fed, which has gotten really, really strong support, particularly from people like Dean Baker and Brad DeLong had this kind of amazing blog post. And, you know, so Brad DeLong, obviously he used to work in Washington, he used to work in the Treasury and is a very, very respected liberal blogger, came out and said that, you know, there's really no reason that that these people should have such sort of like vague but strong opposition to audit the Fed. And so it seems like on Tuesday that amendment is actually going to pass and they're going to have a slightly weakened version of it than the version that Bernie Sanders had written. But that's going to come out on Tuesday. And it was funny, I was watching.
And so you think that's going to pass?
Oh yeah, I think it's absolutely going to pass. I'd be surprised if it didn't. I think there's a chance that it might not, and you know, because obviously there's a lot of horse trading going on this weekend.
And isn't the administration pushing back against it?
Yeah, but they haven't been good at making the case. This was something that I wrote about this week. They just haven't been good about making the case for why this is a bad thing. They can say in sort of very vague terms that central bank independence is important and, you know, that they don't support this because it might sort of hinder them in the chance that there's another bank failure in the future. But they've just never really been able to convince the lefty blogosphere or the righty blogosphere or anybody of the brass tacks of why this is bad. And whereas the audit the Fed folks have been making a pretty strong case for a really long time now that if you double the size of the Fed's balance sheet and a bunch of emergency programs that hypothetically maybe should have gone through Congress, then it's probably a good idea that somebody take a look at them. And so,
Tea partiers and progressives unite.
Yeah, yeah. And it was funny. I was watching Jim DeMint yesterday, actually, on C-SPAN, who was talking about this sort of, like, strange bedfellows relationship that he has with Bernie Sanders, but about, you know, how he's excited to be there to vote for this.
Yeah, that's one. Mm-hmm. Did you have another, or were you...
Sorry, another what?
Oh, I thought you said you had two big issues that are coming up.
Oh, yeah, so was one. The other was break up the banks, which was the Brown-Kaufman Amendment, which was voted down. So those were the two big things that were pushed by the lefty blogosphere this week. One made it across will make it across the finish line on Tuesday. The other is unfortunately dead.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you have on the right our favorite bugaboo, Fannie and Freddie.
Yeah.
Which we're still working on. Ezra had a post that I think deserves some pushing back against. He had a post titled "Explaining Financial Reg, Fannie and Freddie," mm-hmm. and he said, "For another thing, Fannie and Freddie didn't start backstopping the subprime market so long after it taking off." Mm-hmm. And I don't think the evidence supports that, as I later wrote in the Morning Bell.
Mm-hmm.
Starting in 1993, political forces pushed Fannie and Freddie to loosen their once strict loan purchasing requirements.
Mm-hmm.
By 1996, regulations required that 40% of all Fannie and Freddie bought loans must come from individuals with incomes below the median.
Mm-hmm.
In 1995, Fannie and Freddie began buying subprime securities originally bought and bundled by other private firms.
Mm-hmm.
One of these firms was Countrywide Financial, who, thanks to their status as Fannie Mae's biggest customer, delivered investors' return of 23,000% between 2005 and 2003. By 2004, Fannie and Freddie were purchasing, this is 2004, $175 billion worth of subprime securities a year, which makes up 44% share of the entire market. The entire market for subprime securities, 44% bought by Fannie and Freddie in 2004.
Mm-hmm.
These and other factors helped contribute to the 2008 financial crisis. So, I mean, do you think that Fannie and Freddie were not significant contributors to this crisis? And do you think the subsequent amendment that McCain and who co-sponsored with McCain the Fannie amendment?
McCain and Judd Gregg.
Judd Gregg.
And I think that there's a third. I know that that Susan Collins has also come out as a co-sponsor, but then there was a third initial co-sponsor who I can't remember right now.
So how do you handicap the prospects of their Fannie and Fred, which is a winding? Is it 15 years they're going to get rid of it? They're going to slowly wind it down and just have it kind of sell itself off over that time?
Yeah, so I think that, you know, I think that you actually have bipartisan support for the end game here. If you go look at some of the things that again, Dean Baker has written and a lot of other liberal economists in the blogosphere, they've said that, you know, Fannie and Freddie should probably be shut down because the U.S. government's sort of pushing...
That does seem more supportive in his post, though, no?
Well, I think that...
I believe it's something along the line, if you want to have... government policy that props up housing fine,
mm-hmm.
I think was his line.
Yeah, I don't think that anybody thinks that you should have the scale of Fannie and Freddie, which you know, is unsustainable. I think that there's probably eventually going to be bipartisan agreement that Fannie and Freddie you know, should be wound down in their current state. I think as a political point that, like, Fannie and Freddie probably won't exist 15 years from now. I think that the criticism that's starting to emerge of the Fannie and Freddie sort of bill is that this deals with it too quickly, and these are sort of trillion-dollar issues, and this was a point I actually made this week. Fannie and Freddie, it's almost in some way bigger and more complex than financial regulation because, you know, you have this massive, massive government intervention into a private market, which everybody wants to deal with. But, you know, the U.S. government is propping up the housing market right now. You know, there was the tax credits, there was the Fed's program of buying mortgage-backed securities from Fannie and Freddie, and the housing market is quite fragile and a pretty big part of the economy.
No, yeah, Fannie and Freddie is at the heart of Obama's efforts to prop up it up.
Yeah, it's
the opposite direction
of
trying to get rid of it.
The idea is that you don't want to wind it down so quickly that you know, if you jerk that government support out from under the market, then you just crash the market and you're going to need some other government program to save it later. So I think that the criticism of this bill right now is that this just does it kind of like too bluntly and too quickly. That this probably isn't workable, but this is probably a really good starting place for talking about this.
Does 15 years sound too blunt to you?
So 15 years, I mean, it unwinds over 15 years, but after 2 years, they're going to stop buying mortgage-backed securities, and you know that's the, what Fannie and Freddie does, right? They're going to stop most of the intervention, and then it just slowly winds down over 15 years.
Well, originally most of their business was actually creating the mortgage-backed, so they would buy the actual loans and then bundle them. It wasn't until later in the late 90s and 2000s that they really started buying the securities from other people. Mm-hmm. Minor point, but go ahead.
Yeah, so I think that, I don't want to say that the McCain and Gregg bill is sort of, it's not disingenuous, in that I think that they would love to vote on this. They would love to make this into governmental policy. But I think that, like, just looking at this politically, this is a starting point for what's going to be, like, a pretty long conversation about Fannie and Freddie, in which, like, everybody understands that the housing market is so delicately that probably you want to move slowly. But, you know, it's a point of sort of bipartisan agreement that Fannie and Freddie are a really big mess that need to be unwound, and that, you know, the government shouldn't have this sort of massive intervention in the housing market, ideally 5 or 10 years from now.
If I can be crassly political here,
sure.
That sounds awesome, because it's a great thing for Republicans to be talking about every time this stuff comes along. And if we have Fannie and Freddie to kick around and to make Democrats vote to support for another 10, 15 years, great for Republicans.
Yeah. I mean, but okay, so tell me about the pickup in the conservative blogosphere about this issue, because conservatives have been pressing liberals on this. It's been the Obama White House and liberals that haven't wanted to talk about Fannie and Freddie. They don't want to have to answer that question yet.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, what we talk about, we love Fannie and Freddie. I mean, you know, Michelle, everyone, it's like Acorn. It was not as cool as Acorn. It's on the list of righty bugaboos. It's right below Acorn.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's catnip.
Yeah. Yeah. And so the general, you know, do you think that there's been right-wing support rallying behind the McCain and Gregg proposal?
Yeah. I mean, as much as they did, you know, you know, Ed Royce has a much better bill. You know, the Senate Republicans came out with their alternative to the Democrats' financial regulation bill, and you didn't really see a lot of love for it on the right, because it basically was just a kind of softer, watered down version of what the Dodd bill was.
Yeah, it wasn't a very good effort.
No. And so, you know, there just wasn't a lot of rallying on the right around it. Hey, we got an alternative. You know, it's kind of the same problem that the left has with the House and the Senate, is that, you know, the left is kind of more, I mean, the House is kind of more where the left wants to be. Their policies are more in line with how the progressives see it. They would much rather have had Nancy Pelosi's health care bill than Harry Reid's, you know, Harry Reid, if you want to call it, Matt Burns' health care bill.
Sure.
But they ended up having to vote for the Reid Burns bill and not the Pelosi bill.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Republicans are kind of in the same boat, in that it's really kind of irrelevant what Ed Royce comes out with, because there's no way Nancy Pelosi's ever going to allow a vote on it.
Mm-hmm.
And so the only thing that actually has a chance of getting consideration is what Senate Republicans come up with, and then you're letting, you know, the Shelby Corkers and McCains of the world, McConnells of the world, do the stuff, and they're just not as on board with conservative and the Tea Party as the House is.
Yeah, I guess that's true. And also, because, you know, there's a conservative version of this Fannie Freddie bill in the House that I actually, you know, as you mentioned, that I actually don't know very much about it. But it seems to me that, you know, all the action is in the Senate, right? This amendment,
that's
the they're going to try and attach this and fail, presumably, probably.
No, yeah, if anything happens on Fannie and Freddie, and I actually don't think it will, it will happen in the Senate. But like I said, the House is kind of irrelevant.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think it's going to be interesting to see how this shakes out, if they can actually sort of get a Senate vote on this amendment, and if they can actually sort of rally a lot of Republicans to come forward and to say, you know, we're going to vote for this and we expect you to be dealing with this, like, as soon as possible if this amendment doesn't make it in.
Oh, if they get a vote, they're going to get pretty much all the Republicans to vote for it.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that, you know, you've already started to see, they've gone on this push for it, and you've started to see Republicans stand behind it. But yeah, it'll be very awkward. It'll be a good thing for them, you know, politically to force the Democrats to deal with.
Speaking of awkward,
Sarah
Palin had to mend some fences with her Facebook fans this week.
Yeah.
She came out and endorsed Carly Fiorni in Senate, who's running in a three-way primary mm-hmm. with Chuck DeVore, who is a state senator, Tea Party guy, mm-hmm. and Tom Campbell, who is a pretty much former everything, former House member, mm-hmm. Who is viewed as even, well, viewed as the most liberal of everyone in the Republican primary.
Right.
But Chuck DeVore is the favorite, so she comes out with an endorsement of DeVore on her Facebook page, and the Facebook page just erupts in revolution with all these Palin fans uh-huh. basically saying she's a hack, she's sold out, she doesn't know what she's doing, she's no longer the true voice of the movement we thought she was.
Oh, no.
and then she had to come back with an update where she says that, Carly's a strong supporter of the Second Amendment. She's a member of the NRA. She's pro-energy development. She's against cap and tax. And more importantly, she can win. She's no rhino. And, of course, many conservative bloggers in the Middle East came back and said, she flip-flopped. She was for cap and trade before she was against it. Mm-hmm. And Paul, a Powerline, had some more kind of nitpicking, which I thought was interesting. Mm-hmm. He kind of defends Campbell first. He says, according to Sacramento Bee and the National Taxpayers Union, Campbell gave Campbell an A and B grades during his time in Congress, and the American Conservative Union, which takes into account social issues, gave Campbell a substantial libertarian streak, a lifetime rating of 54, which on a scale of 80, which is nowhere near to Barbara Boxer. He then goes on to say that Palin also described Fiorni as someone who grew up in a modest home with a school teacher dad. But then Paul does a little Wikipedia-ing and finds out that Fiorni was actually the daughter of Joseph Sneed, who was a law professor and judge at Stanford and was on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which kind of makes him a little bit higher on the elite scale than schoolteacher dad.
Yeah, ever so slightly, unfortunately. And I think that was in Sarah Palin's initial Facebook post, right?
Right.
Yeah, it was, supporting.
Right. And so just to close out with his line here, he says, mm-hmm. his last line is, am I missing something or is Palin's short statement distorted on two counts? So you're seeing, at Red State, at Powerline, some really red meat places.
Yeah.
Some questioning of Palin's conservative credentials and integrity.
Yeah. So I saw a post which I think was on the corner at the National Review that was pointing out that Fiorina had previously sort of slammed Palin by saying that, she had never been the executive of anything. And
yes,
had,
I forgot about
had
that.
Had made a bunch of sort of nasty comments about Palin, which I think
This being during the campaign.
Yeah, yeah. This was a while ago, but had, essentially said that Palin... shouldn't be running anything.
That she could never run a company, which then when she was pressed on it, she said, oh, but Obama and McCain couldn't either, which was, kind of a lame take back.
Which is, which is slightly better. And so, so what do you think? Do you think that I guess because the question that I have for you is to what degree Palin had sort of previously set up these same sort of conservative litmus tests, and is this like a conservative litmus test that she's sort of... that she sort of failed her own kind of yardstick or whatever. Sorry, I just horribly there.
I've on blogging before I've said that Palin's more in the business of selling Sarah Palin,
yeah,
and not really running for anything. And you sent me a article from the New York Magazine, "The Revolution Will Be Commercialized," which is rightly along those same lines.
Yeah, Gabe. This is Gabe Sherman's amazing article, which is basically sets forth the thesis that, towards the end of her governorship, Palin had kind of her expenses were far exceeding her income just because of, having to do all these new things as a function of having run for vice president. And now she's just turned into this sort of like $12 million money machine.
Right, mm-hmm. right.
And fundraising machine, it should be added.
Right.
And
conservatives are fine with that. We are totally fine with people making money.
Sure.
The only problem is that if your business is going to be selling the Palin brand, you have to protect the brand.
Mm-hmm.
And endorsing Carly Fiorni is going against the brand. You're not serving the brand by endorsing her.
Mm-hmm. And why did she endorse her?
I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Because
I mean, if you're going to go off and endorse, Doug Hoffman up in New York 23, who's a terrible candidate and, you know, has no real chance of winning, then why hedge your bets here and not go with DeVore? I mean, you know, people in red states say, you know, this isn't the first time she's, chose the moderate person, you know, because of course she endorsed McCain over Hayworth, another Tea Party favorite. Mm-hmm. But that makes sense, you know. McCain's the one who plucked her out of obscurity. There's a personal relationship there, mm-hmm. you know, loyalty. It's like, that's easy explainable. But this one, you're just like, you know, why?
Yeah, well, I guess the other question is, why endorse anyone at all? You know, does she?
Well, I think that's part of the business plan.
So that's part of the business plan.
You have to go in and insert yourself everywhere. You have to make yourself relevant.
Ah, okay.
And so you have to go into these races and endorse people because, mm-hmm. you know, we're not talking about her if she doesn't make this endorsement.
Right.
The only way you extend and grow the Palin brand is by making people talk about you.
Right. And to what extent does she, because my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, but she has sort of a reputation as something of a kingmaker, because if Sarah Palin endorses you and maybe will come up and, you know, sort of show up for some of your events, lo and behold, you have this sort of like mass population of people that come and all sort of, you know, donors that are more interested. And so, you know, do you think that Fiorina maybe had reached out to Palin and had asked her? You know, that Fiorina needs the money, but maybe she
I've seen kind of the opposite analysis.
Oh, yeah.
Is that because Sarah Palin has had such a lousy record of picking winners, mm-hmm. that part of the reason she picked Fiorina above DeVore was because she actually wanted to get in the win column for mm-hmm. once. And that, yes, she has brought money to candidates by raising their profile, mm-hmm. but none of them have really won yet.
Ah.
And so she wanted a victory to kind of make herself more of a kingmaker mm-hmm. than just someone who's constantly picking losers.
Uh-huh.
Which is, you know, kind of the more ideological struggle that Jim DeMint is committed to.
Right.
You know, Jim DeMint is not into the DeMint brand. Jim DeMint is into a true believer, honest attempt to change the Senate caucus or the Senate Republican caucus. So,
yeah.
You know, he doesn't care if Chuck DeVore loses. He doesn't care if Rand Paul loses. He doesn't care if I forget who ran against Dan Coats and lost loses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he really is going to try to give the best, who he thinks is the best candidate, their best chance to win. He doesn't care about being a kingmaker. He wants to make the conservative caucus the Republican caucus more conservative.
Yeah, you know, I think he's like actually, I find Jim DeMint completely and utterly fascinating, and think that he, and then who's the representative from Wisconsin, the one who's on the budget committee?
Ryan.
Yeah, Paul Ryan. That they're kind of like they're almost analogous to each other in the sense that they have this kind of like unbelievable ideological integrity. And I think actually stand in contrast to a lot of other Republicans, and frankly a lot of Democrats also, that they just seem so absolutely principled about these things. And I know that I remember it was DeMint who said that he would rather have sort of like 30 true conservatives.
Yep, that's DeMint.
Yeah, than you know, 61
right.
Not true conservatives, which is funny because and you think that Palin is kind of like, you know, something like the exact opposite.
Yeah, I think that's what this episode kind of proves.
Yeah, and so you know within the conservative blogosphere, you kind of wrapped up a little bit of the reaction to the Carly Fiorina disaster. And do you think that it's like symbolic of anything else that's happening with Sarah Palin? Because she's going through this entire sort of career and reputational readjustment, which I think has been really really interesting to watch happening on the right.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really know what your question is there. I mean,
we still really like her.
Of? You know,
because you mentioned that she's sort of repositioning herself as somebody who is kind of representative of a kind of political brand. But to me, it seems really unclear what Sarah Palin is kind of doing.
She's making money. We covered this.
Yeah. I don't think this.
Yes.
Yeah, I guess so.
And we're fine with it. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it's the same business that you know, Rush Limbaugh and Mark Levin and a lot of these other conservative entertainers are in.
Mm-hmm.
Glenn Beck.
Although, I mean, do you think that Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh's raison d'etre is, like, to make money as opposed to advance, like, a conservative agenda? I mean, not that those two things are at all at odds with one another.
Right.
Yeah. But it's strange to, you know, because this is the whole thing about being a politician is that, you know, you sacrifice tremendous amounts of money in order to sort of, like, go do this social good. Whereas I think it's been sort of weird watching Palin kind of, like, flim-flam around and trying to find her, you know, sort of niche as a conservative commentator and a conservative voice and somebody who advocates.
Yeah, I think we're definitely in the early process of that.
Yeah, yeah. And thus far you think she's not doing great?
No, I think for most part she's doing good. This was just a big misstep.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
We're minor, we'll see. Definitely a misstep, though.
Yeah. Well, it hasn't... I haven't seen much pickup in the liberal blogosphere. And normally, if Sarah Palin does something, like, you know, makes some crazy gaffe, there's nothing that delights the liberal blogosphere
I think you're just proving her point.
Yeah.
She becomes more endeared to her fans when Keith Olbermann makes her the worst person of the world,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, everyone else in the lefty universe is calling her an idiot.
Yeah.
That what makes us love her and turn out for her book events.
Mm-hmm. And still... You know, like, sort of 18 months into it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, the idea that she was treated so unfairly during the campaign is so ingrained that she can beat that horse for a while.
Yeah. All right. Well, that makes sense. She's definitely fascinating. I haven't been paying nearly as much attention. I feel like I should watch her on TV and watch this kind of, like, transition happening.
Knock yourself out.
Yeah. I guess so.
Okay. Our second last item on the agenda. Do you want to do immigration or Miranda?
I mean, it's up to you. The Miranda thing I haven't followed nearly as closely. The immigration thing I have a little bit more.
Go for it. Tell us your thoughts on the developments in the immigration world this week.
Well, so I think that. I think that Arizona, which happened, it happened 2 weeks ago now, right?
Mm-hmm.
It remains the sort of like a shadow over shadow that's sort of casting shadow over everything, and I think that attention has sort of turned away from the question of there was this question in the lefty blogosphere of whether immigration reform was going to come first or whether climate change legislation was going to come first. And you've had these two kind of like twinned catastrophes on either side, right? So we've had this horrific oil spill, and then we've had this you know, what's considered in the lefty blogosphere that is just utterly incomprehensible law in Arizona. And then on top of that, you know, it's been a very busy legislative week with financial regulatory reform. But I think that's, you know, that's the question. Everybody's just like looking forward and saying, well, you know, which one of these priorities is going to go forward? And I don't think that we're going to know that until after financial regulation is done. Because actually, I think when it comes down to it, you know, the Senate calendar is going to determine what happens here. And I think the lefty blogosphere is just waiting for the sort of courts to take over in Arizona and to hopefully see that law declared unconstitutional.
Wow. Well, it doesn't come into effect till August. And then, you know, a cop somewhere has to do something stupid,
mm-hmm.
and you're talking years, not months.
Sure. Yeah. It's a long time frame.
mm-hmm. So I guess what you're saying is immigration reform is not happening this year in the Senate.
I mean, I never realistically, yeah, you know, in some ways I wonder if it doesn't benefit, I think that there's a number of issues that, you know, Democrats don't really want to have to deal with this year. I think that climate change will end up going forward, you know, because of Lindsey Graham and because hopefully the politics there are a little bit easier. Yeah, but, you know, I do think that it raised the question of which could go first and what the, you know, the Democratic Party was going to prioritize. No, I don't think that there's, you know, I don't think that, frankly... Speaking cynically, I'm not sure that the chances that either will go forward are particularly good at this point. And again, you know, I thought that financial regulatory reform was going to go pretty quickly, but now because of the amendment process, they're saying, you know, it was this week that Harry Reid said that people should cancel their August vacations, and it's like, oh my God, are they really going to be talking about it for the next 2 months?
Yeah, they just might be.
Yeah, I suppose so.
And then we got a Supreme Court fight on top of that.
Yeah. I mean, hopefully that won't be much of a fight.
We'll see. The two things I wanted to add on immigration was just as a sports fan, seeing it bleed over, see my MSNBC viewing bleed over into my ESPN viewing.
Mm-hmm.
You had the Suns, you know, deciding to announcing that, you know, in solidarity with Hispanic community or Latino community, as they call it, that they're going to wear their Los Suns jerseys, which you know, first of all, isn't even proper Spanish. And second of all, they do it all the time. I saw the jersey and was like, wait, you guys wear those all the time? This is a marketing stunt, not a protest.
Uh-huh.
But then you went ahead and you had the governor of Arizona doing a guest post on ESPN.com,
mm-hmm.
Which doesn't happen every day.
Mm-hmm.
Just laying out that, you know, the Arizona law creates a penalty, state penalty to mirror what is already a federal crime, saying that the law enforcement cannot randomly ask anyone about their immigration status, much like the enforcement of seatbelt laws in many states.
Mm-hmm.
And I was surprised to see this argument being picked up even by some sports celebrities. You had J.A. Donde,
mm-hmm.
who's often on PTI interviewing Phil Jackson. And Phil Jackson, who has a history of kind of being more of a liberal, pushed back against Donde when he was talking about how terrible this law was. Phil Jackson told him, am I crazy or am I the only one that heard that this law says we just took the United States immigration law and adapted it to our state. So you have kind of more celebrities taking out this debate in new sports forums, which I find interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And I also just want to say one tweet of the week, which was got wide play on the left with that Suns jersey event. At Jim Sharp said, here's how the Suns can avoid being called hypocrites. Don't man the arena gates, and whoever sneaks in without a ticket gets to stay. Which I thought was a good analogy of the situation. But yeah, it's interesting to see with both the oil spill and the immigration debate,
mm-hmm.
How I think the left is overplaying their hands. Because you know you look at all these polls that came out last week. In into this week, the New York Times poll, the Gallup poll, the Fox poll, the Rasmussen poll, all showing that between 51% and 61% of American voters support the Arizona law.
Mm-hmm.
So I just don't see how they're able to turn a law that actual majority of Americans support into a way to pressure the Republicans into going along with their preferred policy plan.
Yeah, well, I think that. Yeah, you know, I think I disagree with you about the brass tacks. I don't think that actually liberals have been overplaying their hand when it comes to this law. I think the law is pretty outrageous. Chris Hayes at The Nation, I think, obviously fairly far to the left, was one of the people who had the a really good response to this, which is that, like, you know, it's probably illegal. A lot of people on the left, the lefty lawyers, believe it to be illegal. But, you know, more to the point.
When you say illegal, you mean unconstitutional?
Yeah, unconstitutional.
Do you know what grounds they're pushing that on?
You know, I actually don't. I don't know a ton about the sort of, like, technicalities of this. But, you know, I think that certainly in the liberal blogosphere, it's somewhat accepted that this law might not have happened. But then you've also seen a lot of criticism of Obama, sort of, not actually criticism of Obama, but the statement that, you know, had Janet Napolitano been back there, this never would have happened. And there's kind of been...
Okay, you got me there.
Yeah,
that's,
you know,
true.
There's been this kind of, like, throwing up of hands at what can happen. And, you know, as far as the oil spill goes, it was Brad Plumer at TNR who laid out this case that the oil spill has actually possibly hurt the chance of a climate bill coming through. Because this,
agreed. That's my instinct, is that, yeah. That the only way you're going to get consensus on a climate bill was to give enough, you know, red state Democrats and hopefully a couple Republicans what they wanted on drilling.
Right.
But now that's impossible.
Yeah, you know, so they're saying that the bill is going to come on Wednesday. I think it was Kerry who said that the bill is going to come on Wednesday. And there's a chance that they might still keep the drilling in there because they just don't have any other carrots to pass out. But, you know, if it ended up being that this oil spill managed to kill the climate bill, I think that would be just, you know, a sort of fantastic irony. And hopefully that won't happen. But it seems that, yeah, they actually might keep offshore drilling, which I'm somewhat astonished by, I guess. But, you know, there has sort of been, you know, an argument made in the lefty blogosphere that if this drilling doesn't happen off of the coast of the United States, it's going to happen someplace else. Ezra had this on his blog, actually. He had an interview with a woman who I believe is at CAP, who said, basically, if this drilling doesn't happen off the United States, it's going to happen someplace off the coast of Africa, where there's going to be like even less oversight over these things, and the environmental disaster could be even worse, and you aren't going to have a massive federal government that's willing to sort of spend the money to go clean it up. So maybe it's better that we keep it close to our shores.
Well, I mean, the only problem with that argument being that, you know, countries in Africa aren't going to be drilling off of, aren't going to be getting the oil off of our coasts.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, you're right. You know, every other country in the world except us is rather aggressively developing their own resources because it's found money. Everyone's tight on cash, mm-hmm. and it's basically just money buried under the ground. Bill Maher on this week Sunday said that Brazil had turned away from oil, which is of course completely false. Brazil is just now beginning to drill aggressively offshore. They have now the technology that they found a whole lot of oil off the shore, and they're in partnership with China drilling it, mm-hmm. who, by the way, is also developing Cuba and Venezuela's resources right next to our borders. So all these countries in our own hemisphere are partnering up with resource vacuums like China to get all these resources out of the ground. Mm-hmm. And Democrats are going to be left behind, being the only ones that don't want to develop this energy.
Yeah, and I mean, I do think that a point that Democrats can make, and that you will see them next week, is that this is that this might still be something worth trading if it means pricing carbon, which is obviously the end game for anybody who wants to start ratcheting down energy use by sort of making it more expensive. And that calculus hasn't changed despite the disaster. And it'll be weird maybe to see Democrats trying to walk back from this and say, no, this is actually, perhaps a reason that it's even more important that we pass this bill in the form that it is currently taken. Because it's been, how long have they been working on that bill? It's been like 18 months or something.
It's been a long time.
Yeah, and to watch all of that work scuttled would be difficult. And particularly, particularly if they decide that they want to go forward with that as opposed to immigration, since it is, sort of one of the peculiarities about Congress that they seem to take these issues one at a time and can manage only to do one big bill at a time.
Seems like it.
Yeah, it does.
If we could whipsaw back to immigration just for a second, because I saw a lot of headlines when Rubio came out and had statements that were skeptical of the Arizona law,
mm-hmm.
and those got a lot of pickup on the left. But then he came out on Human Events after they changed the law and had an interview with Jason Matera,
mm-hmm.
Supporting the new version of the Arizona law, which I didn't think didn't get a lot of pickup on the left, but did on the right.
Huh. Can you explain the flip-flop a bit more?
Sure. Yeah. I have the interview right here.
All right.
Yeah. Jason Matera, if you were the Arizona State Legislature, would you have voted for the law? The second one that passed hit the right note, yes. So, the point that he made in his original statement was that, this could lead to racial profiling. He had some reservations about it. And so after the conversation kind of bubbled on the right for a bit, and I think it became clear that, the weight of the party was going to be in support of the Arizona law.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Arizona legislature came out and go ahead and made this change on to make the racial profiling ban even more explicit. That kind of gave him enough cover to came in and change his position to being in favor of the law.
Mm-hmm.
Going back and reading the rest of his language on it, I was impressed by how he hit all the right buzzwords,
mm-hmm.
in his stated position on immigration. So this is Rubio now when asked by Matera if she supports a path for immigration. Rubio says, "Well, we have a path for citizenship. It's called coming legally into this country. The ones who are already here, you can't do it." And he goes on, he said, "That being said, America cannot be the only country in the world that does not observe or enforce its immigration laws.
Mm-hmm.
A key part of your sovereignty is the ability to keep control and influx of the people into your own secure border."
Mm-hmm.
And so, totally dismissing a path for citizenship, saying the ones who are already here, you absolutely can't do it. And throwing around the word sovereignty, those hit all the right conservative erogenous zones when it comes to immigration speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny. So in that interview, does he get into the, you know, the sort of more controversial, the ability of cops to kind of stop people just because they might suspect that they're here illegally or here with, you know, that they're undocumented?
Yeah, the bill doesn't allow them to do that. Like, you know, like Brewer says, it only allows people to ask the cops to ask for immigration if they're already involved in another lawful contact.
Mm-hmm.
So, like the seatbelt law. Mm-hmm. Most states, cops can't pull you over just because of the seatbelt, but if they already have you over for speeding or stoplight violation and they see you don't have your seatbelt on, then they can go ahead and ticket you for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, I think that as far as Rubio goes, it's sort of curious. So you think that this got a lot of pickup in the conservative blogosphere, and the reaction was what?
Oh, the reaction was he's on board. He's with us. Uh-huh. I mean, I think it was a big telling point for many conservatives because, you know, Matt talks about, you know, the chance of Rubio being a player in 2012, and I've kind of poo-pooed it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he had thought he wasn't ready. This shows me that he actually might be serious about it. This shows me that he's thinking beyond Florida election, and he is thinking about his national standing.
Yeah, just out of curiosity, because I don't know, what's the polling on Rubio and Florida and Crist?
The first one out of the box, I forget who it was from, showed, I think, it was Rasmussen.
Okay.
Showed Crist up. It was like 35 Crist, 32 Rubio. Those are rough numbers.
Uh-huh.
But then Mason Dixon, just a few days later, came out with a poll that showed like Rubio 38 and Crist already falling to like 35 or so, and Meeks hanging around 19, 20 in both polls.
Because Crist's issue is eventually going to be funding, right? That all of a sudden he's lost a ton of backing and might.
Well, funding and enthusiasm.
Sure.
I mean, my Twitter feed is pretty much all political reporters. Mm-hmm. And following the tweets from his rally, it was just like, this thing's dead. There's nobody here. You know, if his campaign is right, this rally, it's going to be over. There's just no excitement for, you know, independent Crist, because, I mean, there's no principal stand or issue. He flip-flopped. I mean, he changed parties on, right? It was just nakedly political. I'm going to get my butt kicked, so I'm going to run as an independent.
Yeah, I can't disagree with you there.
Right. It's not like he said, like, you know, I'm going to take a stand on, you know, education or offshore oil drilling or immigration. It was not like some issue where he said, this is what I'm about. It was just like.
Although, I mean, to be fair, he had been much more moderate. Maybe the thing is that the party had kind of moved away from him, right? That Florida was becoming more conservative as a state, and therefore he looked moderate in comparison. Or am I wrong about that?
Well, the Tea Parties were definitely become a force, and
sure.
You know, I mean, you know, his embrace of the stimulus was, you know, much like, you know, Lieberman's embrace of Bush, his hug of Obama is the same kind of kiss of death, or hug of death, I guess.
Right. Yeah, and so in that sense, as I understand it, his politics hadn't changed, but the states had pretty remarkably, in a
right.
way that, you know, if you look at him within the context of the broader party, you know, there was no reason for him to leave, but if you look at him within the context of Florida, that, you know, he was really left with no choice there politically, and not just sort of practically.
Well, he had a choice. He could have said, I'm just going to serve out my term as governor and then run against Nelson in 2014.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that choice,
mm-hmm.
which he didn't go down that road. That's water under the bridge at this point.
Yeah. And now, I mean, it is. It's like the most fascinating. I'm sort of like, it's an amazing way to watch, just for the horse race politics of it. It's just, you know, it's the gift that keeps on giving.
It is.
Yeah. And I'm excited to. I've never actually seen Rubio like in person. I'm excited for that to happen this fall.
Oh, you're gonna be down in Florida?
Yeah, my parents are down in Florida. So at some point, I'm actually going next weekend, for the weekend after Mother's Day. But, I'm going to go and try and see some campaign stuff.
Well, lucky you.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've had a lot of fun. Hopefully Matt and Bill will let us do this again sometime.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much. And enjoy your weekend.
I will. I will.
All right.
I'm taking the wife and kids to the Chart House on Sunday.
Oh, nice. That's great. Cool. All right. Well, thank you very much, Con.
Yeah, thank you, Anne. Good talking to you.
Bye.
Bye.